Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that gives you a peek inside the minds of some truly inspirational teachers. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Neil Gordon. Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to have you here. We always begin with our guests in numbers, just to get a feel for who you are. So my first question to you is years as a teacher.
About 15, maybe 14 and a half. Did some supply before I got a permanent post.
First year group taught?
Teaching practice year four, that I did a long-term supply with year one, and then first permanent post was year two. So yeah, down the end of the school.
Last year group taught?
Reception age this afternoon. Last year group I taught on a full-time basis was year six.
Most important year group?
Okay, this is full of, I'm going to insult people. They're all important, of course, but I'm going to go year two. And the reason I'm going year two is not just because that was the first year group I taught properly. I think it's about the time when children start to realize their place, their strengths versus other children, and things start to matter to them. So it's a really important point in their development where they're going, hang on a second, they're better than me at this, or I'm better than them at that. So it's a really important point to guide them and really start to monitor their confidence levels academically. So that's why I think it's a really important year group.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, like I say, you can't please everyone with an answer to a question like that. Favorite year group?
I'd say the one you're teaching at the moment is usually the one that you like best. I taught in year two the most, so I think the children in year two are hilarious. Like, they're learning to be people, so they make all sorts of faux pas all the time, which I think is really funny. I think year four have the dial settings just at the right point. So, like, there's a bit of independence there. They're still quite childlike. They haven't quite reached that point of becoming jaded. They're still quite innocent. So I think two or four I'll go for.
They're not yet waking up having a coffee before they go into school and going, oh man. Yeah. And the most important question, number of tweets.
Absolutely no idea. I don't tweet very much at all. And when I do, it tends to be retweets, and it tends to be for me to remember stuff or, you know, state my claim in something I agree with. I try not to get into Twitter back and forth, because I have done once or twice and I get scared off quite quickly by the heavyweights there.
Yeah, I know that feeling. And the focus of this episode is likely to center around professional development, but you're a teacher, leader, avid reader, deep, deep thinker. Tell us about your journey and how you got here.
So I taught in Coventry for 2 years, years two and year three for 3 years. I was shoved into the maths leadership role. We'll probably go into that later and how I ended up with that and then on my professional development. And then at the end of my third year, we had Ofsted, and it was a horrible experience, as many people might have found. But so I was free, single, decided to move to Cairo, of course. And that was my first real time of being almost completely free to teach how I wanted to teach. There wasn't anyone looking over your back saying, oh no, Ofsted won't want this. So that was really exciting. I spent 2 years in Cairo. I got married in the meantime whilst I was working in Cairo, and then my wife and I moved to Seoul, and we worked in Seoul for 5 years, and then I sort of worked my way up through becoming a year leader, a maths leader again, and then I was also holding the position of assessment leader all at the same time in Seoul. It was a smaller school, so things were thrown onto people. And after 5 years there, I've jumped to an enormous school. So I'm in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam. We have, I think I checked this morning, 1,300 1,359 students in the primary school going down from birth up to year six. And then we've got about another 1,000-ish in the secondary school. So we are a large beast of a school out here. Yes, and that's why I announced my first step into senior leadership as being assistant head teacher out here.
I mean, that is massive. I had three schools and they capped out at 1,032 pupils whenever I was working across three schools. So to go way beyond that. And I think lots of people listening will be familiar with the sensation of how Ofsted certainly was, you know, like I said, when you started teaching, when I started teaching. And, you know, I hope that we don't go back there, you know, because we've been moving incrementally away from it. But there are some noises about how results are going to become part of, you know, a focus of the inspection thing. We all know that, it doesn't tell the full picture, you know. So I think, really interesting and varied sort of career. And, you know, fair play to you for making the decision, like you said.
Yeah, and I didn't realize what I was getting into when I moved to Cairo. I thought I was, you know, getting away something new, something different, live abroad, be interesting. And then I'm sitting on a balcony on a Friday evening, you know, looking out over Cairo, and a colleague saying, "You've entered the best paid world tour you're ever going to get." Like, I've never thought of it that way before, but it is. And of course, teaching is the most important thing, but having a different base to live in is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I can imagine. Obviously, in that time, you have spent a lot of time thinking about your own personal professional development, you know, to the point where I said, you know, I very rarely meet people who think more carefully about their professional development than you have, Neil. So I thought, you know, it'd be great to chat with you about that, because I think it's an important part of what we do as teachers. Where does your drive to take control of your professional development come from?
I've thought about this carefully. I don't know. I'm stubborn. I'm never happy with the surface level understanding of anything. I'm never happy to sort of accept anything as it is presented to me. I want to know more and more about that thing. My school career before university was pretty ropey. It was, I didn't enjoy it from about the age of year six. Did not enjoy school at all, and secondary school didn't work for me as well. So I had to go back and, you know, do college and college another few years to get hold of extra qualifications to go to university. And then when I got to university, it was like another world. It suited me, being that I could handle my own learning at my own pace. So my stubbornness that destroyed my school career helped me in my university life, because I just wanted to know more. So when we were having I did a business degree first, because basically that was what I could do. it's what the course I could get onto. So I found things that interested me and went down those routes and read and read and read. So I did quite well at university versus how I'd done at school. And then going through into becoming a teacher, I think it's important to say my vision for teaching and children and learning is giving children choices. We need to give the children a choice. So in Coventry, where I started, this was really difficult to try and give children choices. So if they can't read, do basic maths, their choices are limited. I want them to be able to choose to become to what they want to become, rather than have those limited by their education. So then that's that drive to do the best job that I can do. In Coventry, I had, and I mean, when I say that, when I'm going to talk now, I really don't mean to, I'm not insulting anybody I used to work with. everyone was absolutely well-meaning in what they were doing. I had children who, you know, couldn't count, couldn't read. Especially maths was something that I really focused on initially, because they really struggled in maths. And the only real support I got from school was, and the LEA, was do the math strategy better, was essentially the feedback I was given. So then I started to read around and go, hang on, there must be something I can, not happy with that. There must be something I can do to be able to, you know, take control of this, you know, drive this myself. What can I do better to help the children I was teaching? And so this was 2009, 10 time. And this is, I think, before a lot of what's gone on in the past, how 10 years, 8 years. I've got a bookshelf behind me that's full of books. Most of them are written within the past 10 years based on research. So I was looking around and I found a book. I've mentioned this to you before here and there about by John Myton. And he wrote a book about how he was helping children to learn maths. And he was diving in. And John Myton he's a Canadian mathematician and playwright. He isn't a teacher. Yet he was looking at what actually worked for teaching children maths. So that drive for my professional development just came out of sort of almost desperation in trying to help these children that I was seeing struggling on a day-to-day basis. And basically it never stopped there. Because once I found out, you know, there are things that work, then the reading, the listening, the trying things out, never stopped from that point on.
Do you think it's having that opportunity to go to college and then university perhaps give you greater empathy or preparedness for self-study? You know, because you said university went really well, but almost as if you haven't had the experience you've had, your mindset was in a different place. I mean, I always rue my attitude between the age of like 16 and 22, you know, and I wish I'd been a bit more grown up at certain points in my academic career. You know, it wasn't a disaster, but 37-ish old me looks back and thinks, oh, you could have used that time more productively kind of thing. Do you think that's part of it? And that's what sort of, you know, you've almost then built this habit towards your own development.
I haven't actually thought of it that way. So maybe you're onto something. Certainly I had to make up for my parents, because I obviously drove them insane whilst I was while I was growing up. But yeah, I suppose you might have, this is a therapy session.
I was going to say, I apologize for making this into group therapy here.
you may be right. It may have been that I realized at that point, you know, no one was going to do it for me necessarily. Couldn't rely on the other people around me necessarily, and took control of it. I don't know. It's a very good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we'll branch out into a psychology podcast and just analyze people. I mean, I think you're totally right. I think 2013 was the first Research Ed National Conference. Mm-hmm. So really, there were books about education. There were books about education research, but they weren't necessarily accessible to all teachers, and there's obviously been this big drive for practicing teachers to write books about their practice and how they've used research and things like that. You know, so I think we're you know, it's almost this golden age since 2013. Yeah, I mean, I think 2014 was David Dadao's wrong book. You know, what if everything at university education was wrong?
Yeah,
I mean, that's the one I mentioned most on the podcast because it was the one that had the most profound effect on my thinking.
Well, yeah, by that point, so 2012, I went to Cairo. So I'd left the UK at that point, and then 2014-15 actually had my school in Seoul. We actually had David Dadao come and visit. Around the time of it was after that book was published. Again, I'm very lucky, and I'll perhaps talk about it again later, about working with people at certain points who were the same as me was really helpful as well.
Why do you think it's important for teachers to take control of their own professional development?
So I'm going to apologize. I'm going to contradict myself probably several times during this, I feel, because I'm on the other side of things now. So now I'm not just a teacher and I'm a senior leader and I have some responsibility for helping teachers take control of their professional and also pushing towards, you know, school priorities and things that schools think is important. But I think it's really important for teachers to take. Schools have a limited amount of time and money to provide anything for teachers, for development for teachers, whether it's courses or speakers, whatever it might be. And therefore, by necessity, it's almost usually directed towards implementation. It's like, this is how we're going to do this. And listen up. And this is what you're going to do. We want you to understand this and do this really well, this particular thing. But that doesn't, there's not necessarily there the giving teachers the chance, the time to think about why that is happening. And it's, again, really well-intentioned and probably might work. So phonics schemes, like taking and doing a phonics scheme really well. We do a very famous one here. And doing that really well will make a difference. So actually, that implementation will do better to improve the school, but it's not necessarily improving people's professional learning, because it's about knowing more. The more you know, the more you get from it. So the more you understand, the bigger the picture, the bigger how everything fits together is important. I can look at that phonics scheme and I can go, right, it works because of this, 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 and this. That's not necessarily pointed out in schools. And are we happy with that? Are we happy with it just working? Or do we want teachers to understand why it is working so they're able to pick and choose from what they are doing? So my preference is, yes, we do. We want teachers to know why they're doing something, not just do the thing that they're told to do. And there's almost nothing more frustrating for me as someone who's accepted, just tell me what to do. Like, hang on a sec, because I'm that hype. I don't have that thought process, because mine is, I want to know why. Why are you telling me what to do? And there are people who just say, just tell me what to do. And they're happy with that. But we want them to know why. We want them to have a theory on why they're doing the thing that we're asking them to do. And there's so much available now. I mean, we're at the school. We have a site that hosts, you know, all these podcasts that people can listen to. We've got this library of books that people can have. It's almost too much in some ways that people can choose from. There's almost no reason for teachers not to be dipping into something. And the vast majority do, which is tremendous. And it's just that flexibility and responsive to needs. Hopefully you understand where you are. One of my colleagues came in the other day. He's a very well-read guy. He, again, listens to a lot, reads a lot. And he said to me, what do I read that's new? Where am I going to learn something new? It's like, I can't help you because I don't know what you know and I don't know what you understand. So that's why it's really important for people to take control and keep reading and build in the things that are going to make you as a teacher better. And no one else is going to do it for you. That's the final thing. Schools aren't necessarily going to do that because they have priorities that may not align with yours.
I think that why is so important, because your understanding of the why will determine in large part what the how looks like. You know, I reckon if you talk to me and Chris Such, we've read similarly about the testing effect. But we've had many conversations about how that should actually look and what the important facets of you know, sort of systems that get the most from the testing effect. And, you know, even though reasonably similar careers, but totally different interpretations. Well, not totally different interpretations of the material. Like you said, that big picture. Why are these things happening? Because then we can avoid things that aren't necessarily that effective. You know, like triple marking, that kind of thing. You know, did anyone ask why? Or perhaps it was dressed up with a why that wasn't necessarily robust. But yeah, but also you can then inform how you behave in the classroom.
Yeah, you can challenge those things. You can say, you've got something behind you to back it up. You can say to people, actually, I don't think that's a good idea. Or why is this a good idea? So teachers taking that ownership over it is really important for stopping those things happening.
I'm sure I've said in the past that I would have teachers coming up to me and asking me, you know, this person has said this about what you said. and it disagrees with what you said, I'm all, well, at least they're asking the questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm still in that process. I've moved, so I've been assistant head teacher here for 4 years. The first 3 years were based at the junior campus, so year 3 to 6. I've now moved to our early as an infant campus, so going from birth to year 2. And it's the first time I've had to truly had the time to focus on early years education below year 1 and truly focus on that. And I've got people around me who know a lot more about me about it than I do. That's slightly is slightly scary for me because I'm not used to being in that position where and I can't challenge them on that necessarily. I can ask lots of questions, and I do all the time. So yeah, it's a never-ending journey as well. So that you're developing understanding how it all fits together. What are the common things across the primary school from birth to year 6 is really interesting thing for me at the moment.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, who are you reading? What are you reading about that?
At the moment, I'm reading an absolute ton of government guidance papers. I'm literally at that point in my in my development. Julian Grenier was already on my radar. I find his writing really simple to grasp and understand and put things in a way that is understandable for someone without the early years background. It makes sense.
Yeah, Julian's on my wish list, and I'd love to be able to speak to him. Yeah. I don't know what the Ofsted sort of restrictions are, but I have seen other people like Steve Wren was on Craig Barton's podcast recently. Mm-hmm. So maybe there might be more of a chance, but in my head, it'd be great to talk to Julian because he has blogged before he became an Ofsted inspector and stuff. It's fantastic. What are your guiding principles for self-guided professional development? And I suppose probably most importantly, do you have a system that helps you implement those principles while balancing the time demands of school and family life?
First of all, I'm luckier than most. I say I'm lucky. This doesn't sound completely wrong. I'm luckier than most. I don't have children. I don't have children. I've got a wife who's very understanding and accepting of me as a geek, as someone who reads, who will sit on a beach and listen to podcasts about education, read books about education. The Learning Rainforest I first read sat on a beach in Thailand. So that's what I'll say. I think having school life and family life with children, I am in awe all the time of the teachers we have who do a full-time job teaching all day and then go home to their own children, and having to balance all of that. To me, the most is like reading, listening, sharing ideas. And I said before, I was really lucky to work in Seoul with a group of teachers who really cared about their professional development. Our conversations all day in school were about teaching and learning. And that was the powerhouse of my development, those 5 years where I was, Chris, who I worked with next door, he was the year one teacher. I was year two. And he'd be popping in, several times a day to talk about something that's happened or something he's tried or this went wrong, how should I approach this, or how are you doing this, or whatever it might be, just constantly talking about it during the school day. But again, I don't have an answer because I don't necessarily think that's what people should be doing. People have the right to step away from it, to have that break from it. So it's a real challenge to implement anything. But I mean, taking any time, to me, not assuming what you've read or listened to is correct is a guiding principle for my professional development. Always doubting and questioning, never thinking that you've got it or you're right. But again, that comes down to reading and listening and sharing ideas, trying things out as much as you can. I mean, I will sit at lunchtime, eat my lunch and listen to a podcast, because that's the time I have during the school day to do that. I don't criticize, I'm not criticizing anyone who doesn't do that, who sits in the staff room and talks and socializes. That's absolutely the right thing for them to do during the day. The problem is that I genuinely enjoy reading about education and learning more. So I'm the worst person to have principles about self-guided professional development, because I think I just genuinely want to know and find out more. But it made me think, like, this question makes me think, like, what can we expect from teachers? And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know what we can truly expect from teachers in terms of their self-guidedness, like what they do. We want people to be doing that. I mean, we are really, really lucky in international schools, but there are specialist lessons in primary school. We have ICT, music, arts, performing arts now, MFL lessons taught by specialist teachers. So class teachers have an amount of time out of the classroom where they're not teaching for this kind of thing. That's obviously not the case in all schools. We do have enough time provided to teachers for them to do that. And there are expectations of self-guided study at our school. But other schools, obviously, they don't have that luxury. So what can we expect? What can people do? I don't know. What do you do, Kieran?
I always fall down on the side that leaders probably need to be the ones who make the space somewhere within the school day. You know, I'm a big advocate of using school time. You know, my anecdote is that my computer used to take 20 minutes to load up, so I would get a chapter of a book read in the time before it was available. But I'm always pushing and saying to my head teachers, you know, I think we should give them 15 minutes at the start of this meeting, or 15 minutes, you know, every week, you know, building in those opportunities, because, you know, you're totally right. You know, we happen to be part of this group of teachers who find education as enjoyable and rewarding a hobby as it is a career, but that's not the vast majority of teachers, you know? So I think it's about leaders making the space and encouraging people. I mean, you've got this massive, like you said, CPD library, which people come in and take books from. And so I think that really helps, because then you give people the starting point, you know, that kindle their interest, you know, something that's practical. And you think, well, I want to know more about that. And then you almost go full circle back to question one, where, you know, like the why and the how and stuff like that there. So, yes, I think it's where time is naturally available, it's on leaders. And I'm always trying to give my teachers more time. But I do think that that's part of a bigger conversation about how we use our time in school and sort of the systems we have in place to streamline things, you know, because there are certainly, you know, in most industries, things that can be done more succinctly, more efficiently, and then that builds time for your professional development, you know.
In Cairo, we had to get on the bus at 3. Had to get on the bus. Terrible. So the school day finished. We had to get on the bus at 3, because if you didn't get on the bus at 3, you got on the bus at 4, and the traffic was appalling. I was so efficient then, I tell you. I was incredibly efficient then when I had to get on that bus at 3 o'clock. Yeah, everything was done. Every moment of my school day was timetabled. What am I going to do in this half an hour slot? What am I going to do here? Because I wasn't getting on the 4 o'clock bus and sitting for 2 hours rather than 1 hour at 3. And then I did get time to listen to podcasts as well. So that, that did help.
Yeah, the commute is a big one. You know, I mean, some guests have had massive commutes and so have had time to really engage, you know, like 3+ hour podcasts and things like that there, or read whole books in a week, that kind of thing. Yeah. So there are ways, but it is about a healthy balance, I think.
It has to be them teachers taking ownership. You know, and I'm always worried by anything that stipulates how much of anything should be done, because you just get this compliance. But yes, we've got how many pieces of work have to be done in a week, or how much work market, you get compliance. is it actually of any use? And it's the same with professional learning. Like, we want teachers to be doing it, but stipulating a certain amount of time is, yeah, not necessarily going to be successful.
No, yeah, because ultimately, you know, wherever the teacher goes next, you want them to take that habit with them, you know, because then that makes the system better. You know, we're always talking about how it's not a zero-sum game and that you're, you know, you're building these people up so they can make a similar influence somewhere else. So I think that is massive. Yeah, you don't just want the, is it Mary Mai talks about the difference between compliance and engagement or something along those lines. Someone certainly talks about it. You mentioned something really interesting about questioning, you know, don't assume that what you've read is true. What's your threshold for, okay, I'm pretty convinced that this might be something worth acting on?
The worst thing is someone's read one report and it said this happened in this particular circumstance. One book. I don't know what my actual threshold is, but if it's in multiple places, and I'm again, we're probably talking about me judging the character of the authors as well. Judging whether they are doubtful. Are they that certain? If they're that certain, I'm usually doubtful of it. If it works in these particular circumstances, then I'm probably going to trust it more. I don't know what my threshold, I don't have a threshold. There's certain things that come up again and again and again as working, and you can't avoid them. Eventually, you can't ignore it. And you've got to take notice of that.
It is a tough one. I mean, I think, you know, you mentioned the character of the author. I think reputation is important.
Yeah.
Just because as humans, it's a large part of how we judge things. So you get reputation. I think the coherence within the broader literature. You know, how does this piece into the big picture? The relevance to the application in the classroom is important too. You know, because if a study has been conducted with postgraduates who are conducting their, you know, they want credits for a course they need to complete, well, I want more after that, you know, because some of the best papers out there have been conducted in those settings. Then we need to see what happens after that. You know, when do the children get involved? When do the students get involved? That kind of thing. So, I mean, I've probably got four or five things that I consider when I'm looking at the reliability of the information I'm reading. But those would probably be the three sort of key ones, you know, the sort of watermark, and then thinking whether or not it's worthy of investment, you know. But I think it's just human nature that those kind of things, like overconfidence in your findings, that's a red flag, isn't it? But equally, you know, as humans, we're thinking, okay, what's this person's track record? How much trust can I put in what they say, you know? I mentioned on the Discord recently that I was listening to a podcast, non-education based podcast, and they mentioned neuro-linguistic programming.
Yeah.
Which is obviously held up as the example of, you know, if you look up pseudoscience in the dictionary, it describes neuro-NLP. Yeah. At that point, I was thinking, right, okay, I've really enjoyed what these guys have said. I've taken a lot of what they're on board. But there was no questioning about the assertions made about NLP. And I thought, I now cannot fully trust the information I receive on things I don't know as much about.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that sort of is a play, you know, looking for those markers so that you can inform your decision making. But that only comes through more and more reading and more engagement with the subject. Because the more you know, the better you can think about it, I think.
I mean, recommendations from... You don't want to get into this circle of they've said that's good. So, and I think that does happen in education circles. Like, you know, people will back each other up, but you know, recommendations from other people that you trust. If someone I respect does say this book is great, I do go out and buy it. So that's really important to me as well. But that's my personality anyway. It's always doubtful. It's always that, are you sure? Why? Where is it? I'm never quite certain of anything until a bit down the line anyway.
It's really healthy because there are so many cognitive biases that want us just to take that that thing that agrees with us and just run with it, you know, when actually a bit of due diligence, you know, goes a long, long way, I think, especially when you're in a position of power within a school, because then you are responsible for the actions of and how this will affect other people, you know. So I think it's a really, really healthy approach to this.
And a lot, just again, going back to that being applicable, a lot of things that are written said just not applicable, not worth thinking about in school anyway. So that takes them out of the picture, picture in the first instance anyway. We can't apply this, or it's too difficult to do. So it's not worth thinking about.
Yeah, big time, that opportunity cost. How do you know if your efforts have been fruitful?
I don't know if I have been fruitful. I don't know if anything I've done has been successful. I mean, the big risk in all of this is you head down that wrong direction and you start reading things that aren't necessarily true. I mean, supporting teachers' professional learning and saying, read, and do that. Problem is, going down those wrong routes, you can end up with a minefield of poor practice. But I think when in the school, I think you know you're being fruitful when you start having more detailed conversations. That you're starting to have that conversation where you're referencing other bits of reading that you've done, other bits of knowledge, things that you know about the curriculum. You're debating things in a professional way. Oh, are we sure about that? We're sure about this. What do we think about this? And we're considering this in year, thinking about planning in planning pro formas and things like that. Our conversations are deeper because of the professional learning that we've done. This isn't now a conversation about a piece of paper. This is a conversation about how we want to teach, and it's philosophy. So to me, it's all out of the outcomes and the conversations and the things that are happening around you are deeper because of what's happened. I mean, I've written down on my notes, you start to see the matrix. Because you're building that web of interconnected ideas. Like, you're starting to go, oh, I can see how this bit fits with this bit over here. And the conversation that you're having with other teachers is feeding into that. And also then you start to see where you were wrong. You start to see where you are unsure about things that perhaps you were so certain of in the past. I was trying to think of an example for that, like where I was so certain about something. For instance, I'm never certain. I really think I'm never certain about anything that I'm doing to be so certain and think I was wrong later. I never think I'm right. I'm always doubting myself. I know what things say and what things should work and what things, but I'm always doubting those ways. So within a school, it's those professional conversations that we're having, those deeper conversations. People are making better decisions. I say better decisions. That's my view, based around evidence that's evidence informed, rather than it being because what happened in the past, or that's what Ofsted say in the UK.
Yeah, I think that's a lovely way to think about it, because, you know, I think we're, I don't know, predisposed to, you know, we imagine this station called Made It, you know, you know, we get off and we've achieved everything we hope to achieve, but you never really get there, do you? You're always pushing for more. You're always want to learn more. And so, yeah, thinking about how your environment changes as a result of the changes you've made is probably an easier way to visualize the difference. Because, yeah, if I think about my last group of schools, the conversations of 2017 compared to the conversations that we're having in 2022, that was that was something I looked back on with pride and thought, yes, you know, the richness of these conversations is off the charts. And there were things I didn't know about because my colleagues had gone off and decided this was the thing they wanted to sort of make their area of expertise and stuff. And so I think that's a really helpful way, because we can't put the pressure on ourselves to think, okay, now I'm an expert, or, you know, I am now evidence informed, because, you know, the evidence changes and the discourse develops at such a rate that, you know, you need to be constantly thinking about things and, like you say, refreshing your outlook on different things.
And that's where I am at the moment with the early years parts, is I don't think the conversations I'm having are as deep or reasoned or as meaningful for by those early years teachers. The ones I'm having aren't as deep, because I can't be as deep in the conversation at the moment.
I'm excited for you when you get to that point, because I absolutely love the demand of the pedagogy and the complexity of, yes, particularly with early mathematics, but even early reading, you know, it's amazing. And so I'm excited for you on this journey, because if I was ever asked favorite year group, it would definitely be in that between nursery and year one ballpark. I'm trying to think if Lloyd actually asked me that when on the 100th episode. I can't remember what my answer was, but it's fascinating. If we shift then to the professional development of others, obviously, you know, experienced school leader supporting others in their development, you know, both on a with school, like you say, with school interests at heart, but also with their professional development at heart as well. What does your approach to supporting the professional development of others entail?
So I've gone into a bit of it. It's the creation of a culture, essentially, where people are trying to help each other improve, where people are challenging each other, you know, professionally, where we're not getting into battles over philosophies and things like that. And where the approach is, we do have a lot of time. We have that ability. We're giving people a lot of resources and things to go away and approach these things. We're very lucky to have time at the end of a school year to celebrate the professional learning people have done on their own. So we'll have, you know, 2-minute presentations, you know, by people just to present things that they learned and developed this year. We are extremely lucky to do that. It's when schools providing that professional development, this is what's really challenging, is when the school is providing some training. Let's go back to that the famous phonics scheme. So that phonics scheme is about they're teaching you, when you get the trainers here, they're going to teach you how to do that phonics scheme and trying to get you to do that really well. But that is to get you to do the phonics scheme really well. But it's also professional development and professional learning. And not everything that is going to be done in that phonics program, at that session, will be directly relevant to what you're doing at that moment in time. So I will learn if I'm teaching in year two, I'll learn about the first stages of reading sounds, but I'm probably never going to teach it in year two here, because by the time they get to year two, they're past that stage. And if they're at that, they do come in and they're at that stage, they're probably going to get some specialist help to help them catch up. But it's not directly applicable to what I was going to do in the classroom, but we're creating an environment where we take the principles, those things that we're learning from that training, and adding it to the bank that's there. I learned so much from following programs, phonics programs, and following really well-designed schemes of work in maths. Like I took phonics things I learned from a phonics program, and I've used them in year six. So trying to say to people, like, are the things that we provide to you in a school are not going to be necessarily directly relevant to what you are teaching now. Use it as a learning opportunity and think, how does this fit in with what I understand? How does this fit in with everything else that I know? So that you can think, you know, why am I doing all of these? Why are these things important? The only other point is letting people go off to do their own things. I keep coming back to that. There's a big risk to that in letting people going off and learning the wrong things and potentially spending time that could be used for other things. So we've got this stuff that the schools provide. We've got the stuff that we provide teachers with, and hopefully we're pushing them towards the stuff we think is good and going to be worthwhile. We're hoping they don't go off and do something that isn't is wrong, or we think is wrong. And then even in those things that come in for implementation, what are you, did you take from that, even if it's not directly applicable to what you're doing in the classroom? That's sort of the pathways of how I think about it.
Phonics training almost gives you this predisposition to engage with the research into how children learn to read. Because I'm almost certain that whenever phonics was sort of first pushed in England, I was given training without really understanding what it was I was doing. But I could teach children phonics, if that makes sense, you know. And it was only after that that I then understood how those pieces fit together. Do you have like a mental map in your mind of how you want all the pieces across your, say, an academic year or maybe 2 years? Because I know you sort of set yourself a 2-year plan for sort of reaching your next sort of big milestone as a school. Do you have that written down, or do you just see the connections yourself?
It's spinning plates in some ways, because we are a big school, and we've got certain programs, certain things that we want, certain schemes of work that we need to be maintained and continue, and not go off track because it impacts on the children's development that they're going through. So yeah, there's a lot of plate spinning. There are some things that that every year we will do. That's certainly the case. Phonics training is is number one at the moment. We will always have phonics development, something with phonics, either consultancy or whatever it might be, just keeping us on track, to keep us going on that. So those little bits and pieces have got to be a place to spin. And then it's one of our priorities is constantly based around formative assessment, because it's basically the cornerstone of everything we do as teachers. But if you're not getting that right, then we're not teaching well. So having those big things that we want to focus on actually sort of keeps us in line where we want to go. Is that what you're asking? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I appreciate it was a curveball that you didn't sign off in advance. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's like, you know, how do you maintain, you know, the course while taking consideration of all these different things that might be there? And I think, yeah, that's a really good example in that, you know, if your practice with formative assessment is effective and it's continually developing, well, that's the nuts and bolts of effective teaching, isn't it? You know, and then everything, it's just little hooks on that to change, you know, your practice in different ways. And so, yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. And I think it's a very sensible way, because, yeah, you're talking about spinning plates. You know, there's never a way to know exactly whatever, you know, but it's a case of, you know, having this mental picture in your head of, you know, okay, I need to spin that plate a bit more than this one this year now, kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm with you. How do you select your whole school priorities, and how do you ensure that they remain priorities?
Okay, so I mean, I don't want to give a boring answer to this, but it's everyone. we're really lucky that we do get, we're able to have standardized assessments for every child every year. Again, I don't, schools in the UK, obviously, England obviously have their SATs tests, maybe that keeps them in line. We pay for standardized things to keep us in line and check where things are going. There are benchmarks, essentially. Are we still on track? Is there anything going awry here? So we use normal marking now, which is just tremendous for us as an international school to compare ourselves to schools where the majority are in the UK to see how we're doing is absolutely incredible. And then it's basically an absolute ton of input from teachers, parents, leaders, everybody, just things come up all the time. And the difficulty is we have a load of people. you know, we've got 64 class teachers across the primary school. Then we've got specialist teachers on top of that. There are 15 teaching assistants in one year group in toddlers. So we've got all of this information coming in. Selecting priorities is tough. And then and it's sort of aligning it with our missions as a school. But generally, finding those priorities are things that can remain priorities. I mean, I go back to those, what's a priority for teaching and learning is being responsive in the classroom. So acting on the information that's in the classroom. And it might tweak slightly year on year. Last year was a big push on, bigger push on phonics because we'd just come out of COVID and that was something that we needed to do. This year we're looking more at mathematics. So it's just tweaking the dials slightly on those. We will always have, because we've got a huge community, some of our school priorities is always around the building, keeping the community. And one of the great things about our school, I feel, is we are huge, but we don't feel it. It doesn't feel like a school that's absolutely enormous. I feel that we're quite close-knit. So maintaining community is always up there as a school priority. And then they've got slightly different applications throughout the school. So you've got these whole school priorities at the top, which are hopefully can then be just tweaked as we're going down. And we're going through that process at the moment, looking at phases for teaching and learning, going, right, what do we want to develop in maths this year in early years? What do we want to develop in Key Stage 1, Key Stage 2? How does it look slightly different, those priorities in those different areas of the school? So yeah, it's a big challenge, but hopefully if we can keep some things pretty much regular, teaching and learning will always be a priority. Being responsive will always be a priority. And then just tweaking the dials on where you're pushing and pulling is how we're going about it at the moment.
There are no hard and fast rules when it comes to this. Otherwise, you know, the book on implementation would have been written a long time ago. You know, so I think, yeah, it makes a whole lot of sense to me. And I think, yeah, you can get a lot of specificity within phases or year groups or whatever it might be. But also you've got these broad here, you know, this is what we want to be better at. This is what we want to prioritize for our pupils' experience of their education. Yeah, so it makes so much sense. This next question, you don't necessarily suffer from it, but I know that many international schools do. When mobility is high amongst teachers, how do you maintain the integrity of a 3 or 4 year school improvement plan?
Yeah, as you say, we have been very lucky that Vietnam wasn't a bad place to be generally during the COVID period. We actually have people stay around during that time. It obviously wasn't the same for all international schools around the world. It depended on the impact. We were a long time online, but actually we were able to maintain our staffing, basically. We were able to pay everyone the whole period of time. But then generally international schools have those big turnovers. We're talking 2 year contracts. People aren't on permanent contracts. We're on 2 or 3 year contracts. And, you know, we're already looking at, you know, who's signing for next year, even at this time of the year. So we're constantly looking ahead. But I think just having a clear guidelines for what your really important active ingredients are for a subject is absolutely key. Like these things are, they might not necessarily we do exactly this, phonics program might be, but other things in there are just like we do, this is the way that we approach this. This is our structure for this. We are really lucky again that for new staff members, we have a long time, a week or so to build them into these structures as well, and let them know, you know, we throw an absolute ton of information at them, but we have some simple guidelines for subjects that really helps. It's a one page document for our in-class subjects for English, math, science, and the humanities subjects. So we have those one pages. This is, you know, this is where we get our curriculum from. This is how we assess in the subject. This is how we do these things. And again, those are only tweaked at the ends of years generally. Generally, we're not throwing anything out wholesale and saying that was terrible. Just tweaking those things. So having those active ingredients for our curriculum, having those things, what's really important for our behavior in the school, like what are those key things that we have to go by, which are we're happy with, we're evidence informed, we're not going to throw anything out because we're actually happy that we're probably almost there. You know, we never will be there, but we've got those things in place. That's really important. And then building relationships with outside experts, I think, is really, really important. So we've got our phonics programs. We do something called Let's Think in English. We regularly have these people in contact with us to keep us in line and in track. They get to know the school then over time. So they almost become, they are, you know, they're consultants. They come in and keeping with those same people is another really important part of maintaining that school improvement plan over time. Not throwing anything out just because it's also really important. We might have questions about the way that we do things, and we can tweak those and we can change those and we can dial things down or up. But having the basic structures in place is really important, and having those outside people to come in and go, we know your school, we can give the background, we can work with your teachers on a regular basis, even if it's just once a year, and just come in and give them the basics of what we need for our teachers. It's really important.
Nice. So you're almost trying to create the conditions in which someone can slot in and then begin to flourish in that situation, you know. So here's the minimum that we do. And then from there we develop onwards. Would you be prepared to share one of your one page documents? Because I know that there'll be lots of schools, perhaps not international schools, but schools where mobility is an issue in England that might be interested in seeing how you articulate this. I mean, obviously there's no pressure to do so, but is
if I'm allowed to do it. But yeah, absolutely. If we're allowed, then absolutely. Yeah, no problem.
Awesome. Yeah, because that'd be really helpful. Because I know Lloyd has spoken before about he tries to recreate those conditions where you've got that week, you know, where he only expects certain things of new teachers for a certain amount of time. So it feels like there's a lot of alignment there with your approaches. And I don't know if he does one page, like, you know, it would be like an A4 primer kind of thing. But so I reckon he'd be, you know, number one on the list of people who are interested to find out more. I really appreciate you giving up your evening. I know that it is now reasonably, if not quite, late in Ho Chi Minh City. And I know you've gone to great lengths to prepare for this. So, you know, massive thank you from me. Yeah, all this stuff to do, really is say thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you very much, Kieran. It wasn't as nerve-wracking as I thought it was going to be. So you made it very comfortable for me. And I hope there's something there that people find interesting.
Oh, I've no doubt they will. And I'm really pleased that you found it an enjoyable experience. And to everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.